Welcome to episode 18 of Vashon 250, where we will be examining the Second Continental Congress. It's important to remember that in 1775, we weren't yet a nation, but still needed a unifying governing body for the 13 colonies. Hence, the Second Continental Congress was the de facto national government during the Revolutionary War. It succeeded the First Continental Congress, which had met in 1774, primarily to protest British policies like the Intolerable Acts, which we discussed in an earlier episode. The SCC was in place from May 1775 and disbanded after the war in 1781. It was succeeded by the Congress of the Confederation, which we'll discuss in a future episode. The Congress convened in Independence Hall in Philadelphia after the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, marking the start of open hostilities with Britain. Delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies, Georgia did not send representatives, met to coordinate resistance, raise an army, and seek foreign alliances.
It's, if I can jump in, it's interesting why Georgia didn't send representatives to the initial Second Continental Congress is because they were dependent on the British for protection against the Cherokees on their western border. And so they didn't want to offend the British because of the fear of being open to attack by the Cherokee. That disappeared, as British, sort of didn't protect them. And so they ultimately send delegates to the Constitutional
Congress. Bruce, it was within a year or so, wasn't it, that they did, show up?
Yeah, right. Yeah, Georgia came relatively quickly. Right. But initially, they were afraid of offending the British until the British offended them.
They offended them, yeah. So it's also important to remember that these guys are starting with nothing, really. And so they're putting this all together. And over its six-year span, the Second Continental Congress achieved a great deal, including the following. There was the war effort leadership. At the war's outset, the colonies had disorganized militias. The Congress created the Continental Army on June 14, 1775, and appointed George Washington as its commander-in-chief on June 15th, and we discussed that in episode 15 on May 12th.
Yeah, the other thing that probably was one of the major hurdles that they accomplished or got over was political unity. They adopted the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms in 1775 and the Olive Branch Petition in 1775 to appeal to King George III for reconciliation, which we discussed last week.
And that kind of unity was difficult to achieve, without the British being so recalcitrant, if you will, and sort of the violence that the British sort of responded with. And so ultimately it leads to the Declaration of Independence in 1776. The Second Continental Congress adopts this Declaration of Independence that formally severed ties with Great Britain, which we'll discuss in episode 22 on June 30th.
And that followed up with the Articles of Confederation. In 1777, Congress drafted the Articles of Confederation, the first Constitution of the United States, which we will discuss more, also episode 29 on August 18th.
And then there was also the alliance with France. In 1778, the Second Continental Congress signed the Franco-American Treaty, securing French military and financial support, which we will discuss in episode 31 of September 1st.
We have a lot coming up in the future.
Yes, we do. We're going to be busy.
Yeah, and then also, as sort of the de facto government, they had to deal with economic and legal issues. And so they established the Bank of North America in 1781. And that's a whole story on its own right. And the remnants of that are part of, in 2008, were still part of Wells Fargo. They passed the Land Ordinance of 1784 and the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And, of course, in 1787, the Northwest was not what we think of the Northwest as Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Northern California. It was essentially Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan. That was the Northwest. And the Northwest Ordinance, which we'll discuss in episode 43, really provides an avenue for new territories to become states.
So this litany of achievements is really no small matter, especially if you consider there were no cell phones, no telephones. It just took time to get everything done. So the fact that they got all this done is pretty amazing, and it should be celebrated. The Second Continental Congress ultimately laid the foundation for the later United States government. So if we move ahead and look at the history, during the last 250 years, there have been numerous times that Americans have attempted to create new constitutions to better serve the will of the people. What are some of the most significant of these historic events? Every state that has joined the Union since the original 13 colonies has formed a constitutional convention to apply for statehood, to write a state constitution, and to hold elections. Most echo the U.S. Constitution, but a number of them have introduced innovations that we might want to consider for our national constitution.
One of the things that state constitutions do that the federal constitution doesn't do is provide for the election of cabinet secretaries. You know, so in the state of Washington, you know, the Secretary of State is elected, the Attorney General is elected, rather than being appointed by the governor. And those are all designed to sort of limit the power of the chief executive in the state, something that we see might be helpful in the American Constitution, particularly given the circumstances we see today. So things like superintendent of education, you know, in Washington State, you know, the Secretary of the Natural Resources, the Attorney General, as I mentioned before, lots of ways to limit the power of the chief executive. Whereas in the U.S. Constitution, there are very few limitations on the power of the chief executive, particularly if you buy into this concept of a unitary executive, which is, Craig, you might want to comment on that sort of legal concept, which, you know, it's relatively new in American judicial thinking.
Yeah, and hopefully not long-lived. all the work of the Continental Congress and throughout the decades has been an attempt to balance through checks and balances, through the checks and balances that relate to the judicial, the executive, and the legislative branches. And we see the pendulum swinging through those from time to time. Early on, we saw the United States Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison say, we decide what's constitutional and what's not. Nobody else. Executive doesn't get to do that. The legislature doesn't do that. Then we had periods where the legislatures were very strong and the executives were not as strong. And then more recently, we see this arrogation of power to the executive in every single place possible, pushing the envelope and seeing if there's any pushback. So if you've got an executive today that wants more power and a legislature that's not willing to exercise the balance that the founders had anticipated, then you're going to have that pendulum swing all the way over to a very, very strong executive, and things are going to, if you will, get out of balance in those circumstances.
And part of that comes from this concept of that a number of Supreme Court justices seem to hold, is that this sort of originalist argument, if the language isn't there, you know, then it sort of goes back to whatever, you know, the language itself says. You know, you have to imply the meaning. And so if it doesn't specifically reserve something to the executive or prohibit the executive, then the executive has free rein.
Yeah, let's as a former law professor, I used to have my students tell me, just tell me what the law is. And I'll memorize it, and that's all I need to know. And I go, well, it's not quite that easy. you'll have a fact pattern like this. You'll have a fact situation where there's this kind of balance and swing going on. There's a spectrum. The Supreme Court can look at the language of the Constitution, and there's a lot of room there to come up with supportable, valid arguments. There's not just, there's only one thing, and that's the what we have to do. It's not necessarily that easy. And that's when you've got Supreme Court justices that are acting truly in good faith. Not that our current ones aren't, but that are philosophically they're willing to listen to their fellow justices, etc. But when you have real partisan justices, you'll have one extreme to the other, as we've seen recently in cases, and some open animosity between the majority and the dissenting opinions. I always loved the dissenting opinion. I think Thurgood Marshall started out his dissent one time. He said, I must respectfully dissent because the majority opinion has no basis in fact, law, or logic.
Oh, yeah. What else?
Other than that.
Yeah, right.
We're good to go.
So one of the things a lot of state constitutions do is they provide for the election of judges rather than the appointment of judges. You know, as a legal scholar, what's your opinion on the election?
Well, it has
of judges?
Its pros and cons, obviously. typically, appointed judges are generally appointed for quite a lengthy period of time. The feeling is you want the citizenry to be able to determine who your judges are. But in practice, I can tell you, I get about 100 phone calls just before a judicial election.
Who are these guys?
Who do you recommend that I vote for? I don't know anything about them. I don't know anything about their judicial philosophy. A lot of these purely democratic approaches applied a lot easier when you had very small communities. Mm-hmm. But in larger communities where you know very little except for the advertisements, it's very difficult. I like the idea of actually having the judges appointed, but appointed by a cross-section of appointees that are lawyers and private citizens, and a number of states have that methodology for appointing.
A nonpartisan, relatively body.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of state constitutions also provide a more robust Bill of Rights in terms of, yeah.
Great. This is a subject that I just love, because a lot of people don't appreciate the fact that when the United States Supreme Court says that the Constitution doesn't provide this protection for individuals, okay? They could have said, we're doing away with the Miranda rights, or we're doing away with the privacy rights granted for abortions. It doesn't mean that we're bereft of those rights, because their states can still provide those rights. And take the abortion controversy fight that's going on constantly now. The United States, that case, Roe v. Wade, was based on privacy rights. Nowhere in the United States Constitution is the word privacy used. It was a combination of a plethora. We had to look at many different provisions of the Constitution to come up with that right, and therefore we granted the right to abortions. In Washington, when the Washington State Constitution was enacted, they decided we should use the term privacy, because here in the great Northwest, we really value our privacy. And so they have that provision that is not in the United States Constitution. So our Constitution provides us more rights to privacy than the U.S. Constitution.
How does that apply on a regular basis? Because you don't hear about that very often.
You hear about it more often now. Yeah. You started to hear about it a lot when the Warren Court, liberal opinions were chipped away at. by the Rehnquist and the justices that came later. And our Washington State Supreme Court justices would say, okay, all right, so that's not protected under the United States Constitution. Oh, wait a minute. We've got a constitution. And they started issuing opinions saying, we don't even have to talk about the United States Constitution. We can decide this totally under the state constitution. So more and more, you see advocates, the lawyers that are pushing for various rights at the state level, researching this, looking into it, and making these arguments that weren't made before.
And that's an interesting shift over the last 50, 60 years, where in the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. Supreme Court was sort of the leading edge of defining individual rights. You know, in sort of the last 10, 20 years, you know, the Supreme Court has become much less liberal, if you will, in definition of individual rights, whereas the states
filling the gap
have been filling the gap, as you say. Yeah, it's a really interesting shift. It sort of has turned itself on its head
right
in the last 60 years.
Right. That's the interesting thing, and you'll talk about this, or we'll talk about this later, about that whole relationship between the state and the federal sovereigns.
Exactly. Another thing that comes out of many state constitutions is this concept of home rule. Many state constitutions define the powers of cities and counties, whereas in the U.S. Constitution, it's only national power and state power. And so it provides an opening for other kinds of legal entities, other kind of civic entities, to have well-defined powers. And the same thing with budgets. The U.S. Constitution says very little about budgets. Some legislation provide for budgets. And I think the Constitution provides that the Armed Services budget needs to be reviewed every 2 years. That's in the U.S. Constitution. Because of the fear of a military. But other than that, you know, whereas many state constitutions have requirements for balanced budgets. And the same thing with direct democracy. The whole sort of progressive era institution of the initiative, the referendum, the recall, which were sort of putting decisions back in the hands of voters, because of the result of the corruption of the late 19th and early 20th century, become an avenue for individuals and citizens to have a voice in creating legislation.
Now, what's the difference between direct democracy and representative democracy?
Direct democracy is everybody has a vote on every issue. You know, and that's, you know, of course, problematic. But that's what the initiative and the referendum and the recall provide, is that, you know, if you're unhappy with your representatives, you can bypass it.
Right.
Not easy.
Right. It's a check on representative democracy.
Exactly. So it goes back to that constitutional concept of balance of powers, checks and balances. Mm-hmm. You know, well, there was no check on legislatures until you get this progressive reform movement in the early 20th century. And they said, wait a minute, you know. And part of that was U.S. senators were not elected by individual citizens. They were elected by state legislators. And part of that change was to say, wait a minute, we as citizens want to vote on who our senators are.
Right, this all goes back to the Massachusetts Compromise that will be spoken of later.
Exactly.
Yep. So the other, all of this leads up to that the U.S. Constitution provides a process for amending itself. Craig, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, every amendment has been created by a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress or the convention, a convention called by two-thirds of the state, which has never happened. That's never happened. There have been 33 amendments that have been approved. 27 were ratified by two-thirds of the states. 6 failed. Regulate. Oh, yeah. The ones that failed were the regulating the number of seats in the House in 1789, the strip nobility titles of citizenry in 1810. I was sorry to see that go.
sorry, Your Highness.
Count Craig from...
So I couldn't even fake it anymore. Slavery protected in 1861. Happy that's gone. Child labor, again, 1924. Equal rights in 1972. And D.C. Voting rights in 1978. So, those six failed, unfortunately.
So it's and it's interesting to look back if we go back to that direct democracy idea. I had the pleasure of, at the ripe old age of, I don't know, whatever you are, in sixth or seventh grade, of seeing the Tacoma city council and mayor recalled. Oh. And that was a very interesting social studies experiment. And, you know, I remember knocking on doors and all that kind of stuff. And ultimately, a couple of the council people were recalled, and the mayor was also thrown out, only to be elected to the state legislature within a year or two, where he finished out his career in life.
That was the 70s? Was that the 70s?
It would have been late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, right.
Slim Rasmussen was the mayor.
Yeah.
And there were racial issues. There were business issues. There were all sorts. The city was really screwed up. And it was about the time Weyerhaeuser decided to pull the plug and leave town. And all the retail left with it.
There were allegations of mob details.
Really?
Yeah. Hard to believe.
Hard to believe in the city of destiny.
We live in the midst of an ongoing constitutional crisis today that has developed over the past 5 or 6 years. So what lessons does the Second Continental Congress offer for us today? Greg?
Well, I don't know if the Continental Congress anticipated. Well, I guess some of the members of the Congress anticipated it. The assumption was that everybody was going to recognize the history and the issues that required required checks and balances and men and women of goodwill. Right now, that is being tested to quite a degree. There is an attempt to capture as much executive power as possible through executive orders, things that clearly you can't do via executive order until you try it and nobody stops you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've done it. And you have then brought this extraordinary power to the executive branch. And if the legislature, Congress, the House and the Senate, if they won't stop you under the methodologies that they have by law, they're just not exercising those, then the only last chance is, well, there's two. One is the judiciary, and of course the other is the citizenry at the ballot box. You just got to be careful that we don't get to the point where the citizenry is X'd out of their opportunities at the ballot box.
And I think one of the great lessons of the Second Continental Congress is that they created the Articles of Confederation because of the fear of a powerful federal government. And that didn't work very well, and we'll talk about that in the future. So they come up with a constitution and a sort of arguments over the powers of the federal government that you see in the Federalist Papers, which we'll talk about a bit. Really become the essence of what you just talked about, Craig, is how do you create a check and balance system that actually works? And that's where we see ourselves today, is we're really confronting that. The checks and balances don't seem to be working in the way that they were intended to work.
And that they've traditionally done.
And it's aggravated when you have the perfect storm of one political party and one political philosophy that is predominant in all three branches.
Mm-hmm. Which hasn't happened that often, but in the 20th century, you see that in the 1930s with FDR and the New Deal, and you see that in the 1960s with JFK after the assassination of Kennedy, and sort of the passage of a whole range of civil rights actions and personal rights actions, because you know the House, the Senate, and the presidency were all controlled by the same party. So the idea of checks and balances is great, but you got to have checks that make the balance work.
That's right.
So in our remaining minutes today, let's take a look at Vashon. And what are some, and there's a litany of events that echo these constitutional crises. So Bruce, you want to start?
Yeah, and we've got Craig here, who was a chair of the community council for 5 years back in the 1990s. And so one of the things I think that's a lesson for Vashon is the creation of what we have now as community council. Operation Jigsaw in 1962 made the recommendation for some kind of civic assembly, some kind of community council to sort of help make decisions for the island. Because up until that time, there was no voice for Vashon other than through the Chamber of Commerce, the Businessmen's Club, churches, organizations, that kind of thing. And so what you get is in 1962, the creation of the community council. And that's an interesting story, just because group comes up with the idea of calling themselves the community council. They send Fred Schlick down to Olympia to register the name. And the day before, somebody else had registered the name because they didn't want a community council. And so they ended up having to call it the Civic Assembly. And then the Civic Assembly functions for a few years. It sort of goes dormant in the early, mid-70s. And then in 76, it's revived by a group led by Gene Amelochson, Pat Longy, and John Pearson. And it goes through a number of various configurations. At one point, it's organized, clubs have representatives to the community council. Geographical parts of the island have representatives. It takes the form of a town meeting where anybody can come and anybody has a voice. Craig, you were part of that. Maybe you can talk.
Yeah, the analogy to the Continental Congress is strongest in the sense that nobody's really clear what the community council is. Is it a democracy? Is it a representative form of government? Is it any kind of government at all? Do they have any power? Does the board of the community council, do they have any power? I remember when I was the chair, we would have elections, and they were elections that were held on the same day as the national elections at the elections spots. And then when we'd have our first board meeting, the board members would go, "Well, I don't have any power to do anything." And I said, "Well, we have a great deal of power. We set the agenda for the meetings. So these are the issues that we're going to discuss and the ones that are going to come up and be voted on." But it's always been an issue as to how much power the community council should have, and because people all want to have more control. But then again, do you really want your neighbors to be making these rules?
and that's part of the issue that comes up in 2011 when the council is dissolved. And Craig, you know about that. Maybe you can just say.
Well, I did.
Words.
I tried to intervene. I had left the council at that point, but I knew the individuals who were suing the volunteer board members, and of course, volunteer board members don't like to be sued or have all their emails brought to light, so they all left, but that was an unfortunate time. But yeah. It's back. The yeah. Community council's back.
Yeah, it came back in 2020. David Vogel sort of pushed for reforming it, and then we'll come back and talk in future times about all the attempts by Vashon to break away from King County to form its own sort of government. So it's always been this sort of conflict on Vashon about who we are, how we govern ourselves, quote unquote, and who speaks for Vashon Island.
And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week for episode 19.